usually think about enlightenment as something that solves our problems. Yeah. And that sounds appealing, right? Like, I can almost taste it. And so we go kind of looking to manufacture something to wake up, you know, and hope that that kind of resolves the various forms of friction in the heart. But I think maybe it's reversed. Maybe it's something more like awakening, enlightenment arises when we have no problems. But what could that possibly mean, to have no problems? That's kind of a foreign notion, right? Does that mean that we banish the first noble truth, that there is dukkha? Right? Does that mean that somehow we resolve all the complexities of being human, the sorrows of being human? I don't think so. When we talk about, like, to have no problems, what I think is being pointed to is a life without friction, or a moment without friction. Now, much of what we actually rely on to create less and less friction with our life is samadhi, unification of the mind. And so tonight I wanted to talk about samadhi, talk about the unification of the mind as a kind of facet of letting go. It's a facet of letting go. So, in our practice, we sit down, and at some level, our work is to come to terms with the human condition, with the kind of existential situation we find ourselves in, with the nature of our nervous system, to open the heart fully to really what it's like to be human. And my feeling is that we actually have to pause deeply to take that into the heart, that we live in a certain kind of form of estrangement from the human condition, and that it's only actually when we start to settle down and, you know, sit, or some practice like sitting, where we actually can slow things down enough that we actually really have a sense of what it's like to be human. In the busyness of our getting and manufacturing experience, that busyness obscures the kind of moment by moment texture of the human condition. And so our practice is to begin to open the heart to that in its particularity, to like have a really open-hearted relationship with that, which is a lot, actually. It's almost unbelievable what it's like to be human. To fully open the heart to what it's actually like. Not what our ideas of it are, or what the kind of models of what life is like proffered in the media or even literature or anything, but to actually open the heart fully to this moment. That's a radical gesture. And that's the beginning of gathering the mind, of unifying the mind, right? Of not actually being split, where one part of our mind is committed to attending, but another part is trying to engineer a particular experience, right? Or trying to, like, almost like barter some moments of equanimity or something for more peace. You know, it's like, I'll trade you 10 seconds of equanimity, but there better well be some serious peace on the other side of that, you know, or this need or this heart or this, right? So we are very kind of transactional with our mind and our life. And this kind of very pervasive sense of like living for another moment, of waiting on something, of really of restlessness. And restlessness is said to be with us until we're very, very free. That particular current of the mind is there sometimes subtly, but is there? There's like this subtle tumbling forward, right? And so we see that we're almost always waiting for something. Even sometimes just the next breath, or for this breath to end, the exhale to begin. And that sense of being like standing at the edge of the moment, just like waiting for something. And in practice, as we begin to gather the mind, there is a sense of a certain kind of waiting, but it's like we're waiting for nothing. Like there's no sense of like another moment where our redemption lies. There's no sense of fiddling or fixing or accumulating or moving somewhere. That sense of like becoming, of I will become, I will have, that starts to become more and more quiet. And so we wait for nothing, and that means that we're living this moment in a sense really like that this is it, you know, like this is it. And something in the heart actually starts to relax when we, that aspect of the mind that's manufacturing starts to settle. And so you can see how this developing quality of samadhi is very closely related to letting go. To a kind of open-hearted relationship with what's here. Now, samadhi, I would say, is what really transforms the Dharma into something more than a philosophy. The Dharma is, it's a pretty good philosophy. Yeah, it's got some cool ideas or something, but I'm not gonna like invest my life in that, you know. Not a philosophy, you know. But it's really actually the mind, as it becomes more limber and lubricated, so the attention starts to really gather, that it's like the teachings start to penetrate the heart in a different way. And the what had been kind of like abstract philosophical principles, or you know, sort of hearsay of one kind or another, it actually is like the Dharma starts to come to life in our experience, and we develop a certain kind of confidence in our minds. And I would say that so much of the teaching, so much of what gets discussed in Dharma talks, actually presuppose a certain level of concentration to really sense some of the potentials of the Dharma. The samadhi, both like this, the mind being gathered in this moment to receive, and also having experiences of the gathered mind in retreat or something like this as a kind of reference point for understanding some of the teachings to which the Buddha points. So this is a tricky territory, right? Because you know, what competes with the unification of mind is being lost in thought, right? Lost in discursive thought, right? And we meditators, we're almost like ashamed of our thoughts, you know? It's like, you know, I mean, how many times have we caught ourselves off the breath or whatever, and there's still this like slightly shameful sort of like bad dog kind of feeling to it, you know, just like again wandering back to the breath, you know, like, oh. And yeah, that kind of sort of subtle embarrassment is like just compounds the whole system in a way, you know. And so one aspect of samadhi is actually like just like the almost like the immediate self-forgiveness that arises when we see what's happened. And of course that whole process of the mind wandering into becoming lost in discursive thought is encased in unconsciousness. It's not actually a deliberate process, right? It's this very opaque process whereby we drift and become absorbed into discursive thinking. So it's just not reasonable to blame ourselves for something we can't have no deliberate control over. Samadhi, for me, one of its like deepest values is in actually establishing faith in oneself and the Dharma. That it's almost like the Dharma and some of these the promises of the path aren't real until we actually see that life can feel dramatically different, and the mind that is gathered feels different, our life feels different, our problems feel different, the way the prospects for our life, everything feels different when the mind is gathered. And so I don't always know exactly how, you know, what the value of certain kinds of samadhi are. I don't know how much it translates into wisdom or these kinds of things. I'm not always sure. But there are like very clear benefits for our sort of sense of like confidence in our own mind and confidence in the Dharma. It's like, okay, I can do this. I remember a very kind of harsh judgment, you know, self-judgmental person who I think maybe went on one of her first retreats, and she came back and, you know, and just had some taste of the gathered, unified mind. And she came back saying, like, I can do this. I can walk this path. Like, this somehow, this includes me too, you know, whereas we are often subtly imagining that we are like the exception to the path, you know, like our mind is a little specially effed up, you know, like that makes the Dharma less relevant, right? Or but it's like, no, okay, this is my path too. So we are in a sense using this gathering of the mind as a way of modulating the nervous system. That, you know, one of the translations of samsara, of this realm, of the human realm, is that it's like being bombarded, you know, that our sensory experience is like always touching us, right? The eyes and the ears and the feeling body, the emotional body, the physicality of the body, like there's nothing we can do to stop the kind of onslaught of phenomena, right? And sometimes we can actually sense that as a kind of bombardment, and sometimes as we get quieter we feel it even more acutely. It's like the impingement of sensory experience, the relentlessness of it. And samadhi is a way, it feels to me often a way of like sort of like turning down the knob on our nervous system, you know, somehow becoming in a sense more porous, so that the world, it's all the sensory experience can begin to flow through us rather than somehow hitting us in different ways. Suzuki Roshi said, you cannot stop your life, you know. You are always changing into something else. Always. Incessantly. This is a definition of samadhi from Shinzen Young. Says, attending to what's deemed relevant. You know, the ability to attend to what's deemed relevant. And we can deem anything relevant, right? People often have a sense of samadhi somehow being narrow or you know, focused on some small piece of experience, but samadhi is actually just like the pliable, malleable, unified field. And it might be very narrow, tip of the nose, and it might be, you know, like a deeply concentrated state on the whole field of visual impressions, right? It doesn't actually refer necessarily to a narrow scope of attention. Shinzen went on to say that, you know, imagining like even if we live just a certain number of years, an average number of years, samadhi, the concentration, actually makes each moment so much richer that what he said was that it feels as if one's life has been much longer.
Yeah.
We're literally living more. And maybe you know that experience of like a really busy day or a day filled with a lot of suffering where the attention is just kind of like gliding about. And the day ends, maybe we sit, or maybe as we're going to bed, there can be that sense of like life slipping by. And I think that is largely a function of the absence of that unified mind, of that gathered mind that touches in deeply to experience. So from this perspective, samadhi is the pleasure of letting go. The Buddha highlights a deep connection between pleasure, samadhi, wisdom. He says, there's no deep samadhi without wisdom, and there's no wisdom without deep samadhi. But for those with both deep samadhi and wisdom, they are in the presence of Nibbana. There are many kind of flavors of concentration, and that kind of people often describe it as kind of like healing, a certain like soothing, healing quality about samadhi, and it ranges from kind of like just a subtle, buoyant, like a little taste of delight, all the way to feeling like the mind body is just fully pervaded. That's actually one of the Buddha's descriptions, like the body fully pervaded by kind of rapture born of concentration. And so people hear that and sounds good, and then our kind of like moralistic Buddhist side is like, I don't want to get attached, right? Like, there's a little like concern about getting attached. And I think we're actually too concerned about getting attached to aspects of the path. And there's a certain kind, we're already attached enough, you know, it's like, but about certain things we like double down and get even more paranoid about potentially getting hooked into it. And I think in part because samadhi is like born of letting go, it tends to like highlight the ways in which we might cling. You know, it's sort of like it holds a mirror up to the ways in which we might cling to samadhi itself. There are, of course, grim stories about getting attached to samadhi. Joseph Goldstein, a kind of now famous story, described a certain phase. He was in India. He was practicing a lot with Goenka, doing body scan stuff. And he described how at a certain point the concentration was real strong. And it was just like a body of light. And he could sit for hours. And it was just so exquisite and delicious. And he was running out of money. He had to go back to the States to earn more money, to get back to India, to get back to his body of light, as he planned. And he goes back to the States, makes some money, goes back to India to get back, right? and he described he said it was like a body of twisted steel. That's how it felt to sit, right? And he said for 2 years, he was scrambling to try to manufacture that focus and samadhi that he had experienced. And so it was like the most painful period of his practice, he said. And but you know, like when I heard that story, I kind of felt like, well, Joseph suffered so that we don't have to. So let us remember that, right? So much of this is just about patience and perseverance, about a kind of a discipline and a willingness to commit to a meditation practice. It doesn't mean we just do one thing all the time, but you know that mode where we're sort of like kind of drifting from one technique to another within a particular period of practice, and we're like kind of like a little metta over here and maybe a little breath, and then we kind of like drift, you know, and we're sort of like improvising our meditation approach or anchor of focus. And sometimes that's it's necessary, like we literally can't do what we want to do, and we have to, but it's really helpful just to be like, this is what I'm going to do, you know. Or maybe you break it up into a couple periods, but it's like there's a certain sense of like, even if it kind of sucks, I'm just going to do something. I'm not going to kind of do the sampler platter, because it just tends to kind of fracture the mind further. So there's a certain kind of commitment to it, but there's an appreciation that our will is not the sole condition for samadhi arising, right? It's like often we get in that mode of just, yeah, like, you know that, where you're like, all right, I'm gonna concentrate, right? Like, enough, Brent Silver. Stop messing around. I'm going to concentrate now, right? And it feels like, okay, that wish, that will, and like the force of that will is like, maybe that's enough, you know, right? But samadhi arises out of like so, like a very like complex web of causes and conditions. And the kind of very attempt to like perch ourselves in the sort of like operating booth, the sound room or something, and like that whole mode is often like there's just more clinging, basically, right? And so instead we're actually practicing letting go. We are, over the years of our practice, learning to sort of like digest our past. That part of what disrupts the kind of gathered mind is the sense of like our past is incomplete, that we have not fully digested our past, that our past is not whole somehow. And over the years of practice, it's like the past memories, different phases of our life, all the kind of intensities that sort of overwhelmed the system in those moments, like that all that arises, and we like bless that with the Dharma eye. You know, we bless our past with wisdom and love. And we just like keep, we sometimes have to do that again and again with certain experiences. And over time, they become more complete. They become more complete. And so we drain some of the emotional charge from our memory. And this means that, like, that memory either doesn't arise as much, or when it arises, it's less sticky. Right? It's like that sort of like compulsive need to almost like lick the wounds of the past, which may be like very important, like an important part of letting go. When I don't think we can short circuit that. I don't think we can just, you know, say like let go or something. Like sometimes it's actually like a wound that takes time to heal. And so we don't look at a wound on our hand and like, you know, like command it to let go or something. We're actually just patient, lovingly patient. And over time, you know, the heart kind of adjusts and makes more space for our past. And then it feels more, it's like we can't be ambushed in the same way. The mind starts to settle. our samadhi is impacted, as is often said, by our conduct, by sila, by our ethical conduct, that we're living in such a way to not create new regret. We're living in alignment with our deepest values, and in doing that, we there are fewer conditions for papancha, for mental proliferation. As one of my mentors said, like, when you act in a way that like is wholesome, ethically right, you, let's just say there's some situation and you do what sort of like feels clear, wholesome, healthy, non-harming, you do that and then you just forget it, right? Mm-hmm. You act in a way that's out of step with our ethical intuitions, and that becomes like a memory. There's some lack of alignment, and that becomes a new kind of wound that we need to tend to, right? Or a new complication that we have to navigate. And so part of our the development of the unification of mind is living an ethical life where there's a real sense of transparency and not being able to be found out, to not need to hide anything, because our secrets actually require a certain kind of like discursive complexity in our own minds. Right, it feels like we sort of like keep secrets somewhere, but that act of concealing from others, from ourselves, that actually requires a certain cognitive effort. And this is moves cross purposes with the settling of the mind. We're learning to let go of the compulsion to stay oriented. To stay oriented to who we are, to what we want, to what we dislike. To stay oriented to time and space. Often when there's a sense of the discursive thinking being this kind of a kind of like reminding me who I am, where I am, what I want, what the kind of landscape of opportunities and threats are, right? And so we actually learn to, we cultivate some sense of safety in letting go. And that's part of why when we're on retreat, we take the precepts and we agree to non-harming, right? And so there's a kind of field of safety that's created, a field of metta, of goodwill, where we actually can let go of some of the kind of evolutionarily conditioned mechanisms of vigilance. And you know, that need to be oriented is like a way of staying safe, of managing my own pain, of managing the threats of the world. And samadhi is this way of dissolving back into disorientation, not in the sense of being lost or confused or bewildered, but not having the ordinary reference points of past, of future, of me, of not me, of what I want, of what I don't want. We're letting letting go of self-judgment and harshness, which is just another kind of preoccupation, another way that we get hooked by the defilements. And so I sometimes say that, like, the self that's loved is easier to forget than the self that's hated. Right? And part of the samadhi is actually being able to forget ourselves. We're letting go of willfulness. So this is Ajahn Brahm. Stillness means a lack of movement. Since will causes the mind to move, to experience stillness one must remove all will, all doing, all control. If you grasp a leaf on a tree and try your hardest to hold it still, no matter how hard you try, you'll never succeed. There will always be some vibration caused by slight tremors in your muscles. However, if you don't touch the leaf and you just protect it from the breeze, the leaf can come to a natural state of stillness. So during meditation, well, in a sense, before meditation, mindfulness, concentration begets more mindfulness and concentration, right? This is part of why we're developing some momentum of mindfulness. We are like soothing and settling the body, relaxing to open to the field of experience. We're establishing some attitude of like, this is enough. This just to be alive is enough. And a kind of alarm bell goes off when we start foraging for other stimulation. No, just be simple. This is enough. To be alive is enough, as Suzuki Roshi said. found it helpful to stabilize the internal gaze, that when we actually close the eyes, it seems like papancha, mental proliferation, seems to co-vary with a kind of the visual field actually darting around. And so sometimes it can be helpful to actually deliberately stabilize the internal visual gaze. And just not fixate it in a tight kind of way, but just like finding a place within the kind of blank mental screen and just trying to hang there. Mental noting is, which we can do a whole talk on, but is often very supportive for people, actually a way of tracking experience. Sometimes as we get more sensitive, we can start to feel like the subtle pull of discursive thinking. Like once we're lost in it, I think we're all equally befuddled, no matter how much meditation we've done. When we are fully absorbed in discursive thinking, that is a humbling experience, right? And there is maybe the habit of concentration wakes us up faster, but my lost is your lost is the Dalai Lama's lost, as far as I can tell, you know. But we do maybe get more sensitive to like that subtle tug of the discursive thought when it's like, okay, we're with the breathing or whatever it may be, and it's almost like you start to develop a little like taste for a thought, you know, like that might be good, you know. That might be, you know, it's like, can start, And there's still some consciousness, right? In the next moment, we may become fully absorbed in the thought, but you can actually sense just that tug, and you just sort of like redouble the effort, the attention. And we keep letting go. We keep letting go. Just keep letting go. And I think what some of the traditional formulations about maps closely to my experience that samadhi in and of itself, there's a lot of goodness arises from it, but it is largely in service of seeing more deeply. And so a lot of times it's at the edges of samadhi. Sometimes samadhi, the mind gets so simple that there's not a lot that's being learned. But it's like softening the mind, softening the heart in such a way that it's like the mind becomes a very fertile ground for being transformed by insight, for the heart being touched at its depths. And we're seeing more because the field of experience has been simplified in a sense. It's less chaotic. There's still a whole complex field of experience arising, but that sense of chaos, of being overwhelmed, is gone. And so we actually can see more and more. It's like the field is simpler, and so the movement is easier to detect. So, samadhi, letting go. A few few minutes for any questions or reflections, and it doesn't have to be about this, really, whatever. You know, it's always I like whatever is close to your heart, I'm happy to engage with.
Yeah.
So the question around the national political situation and the way that kind of can frenzy the mind. So a few things. I think we want to very practically we want to actually be conscious of how much actually to take in, and for me, I sometimes have spent significant time on like a full media fast, actually, and that was largely because I felt like it was not the consumption of the news was not catalyzing action in me at that time. You know, I was not like politically active at that moment, and so it had this kind of effect of being this sort of like, morbid consumption pattern that was just like feeding on itself, and that was like not a healthy way for me to actually engage with the world. I'm not doing that now, but the other component is actually to be doing something, you know, to be expressing one's values in ways that it kind of cuts through that sense of powerlessness. I also reflect on the kind of cycles of clarity and confusion in human history, and that there's a certain kind of like long view of this, like way beyond my own life, and for me, it brings a lot of reflections on mortality, my own mortality, much closer to my heart, because at some level, I feel like many fears and like mental proliferation depends on my own refusal to open my heart to my own mortality. And so that's something that I've practiced a lot with, and it feels so multi-layered, but there's like so many layers of letting go, of opening to the seemingly unimaginable reality of one's own mortality, which is both like totally vivid and clear and believable, and also has this very surreal kind of quality. And as the heart opens to that, and the kind of pain and grief of that. Some of the fears are like drained of some of their charge. It's a time, and I see it's time to wrap up, but that maybe the last thing I'll say is that it's a time, I feel, it's not a time for, you know, for me, this particular moment is, it's beyond the partisan divide, you know. It's like, I'm pretty cautious about how I hold this seat, you know, in relation to some of these things. But this particular moment in our history is beyond the dichotomy of progressive, conservative. It's a different thing for me. And that means that it's in a sense negligent for me to ignore it. And so I do, it is a relevant moral question, you know, in you know, if for the Dharma. And as Howard Zinn said, you can't be in neutral, you know, on a moving train, right? And so it's changed how I actually feel about Dharma and its relation to political action. And the more deeply we cling to our views, the less persuasive we are. We normally associate like the holding with the moral force, but it's the reverse, right? So this can still actually be a time of letting go, of knowing the emptiness of views while expressing them more and more compellingly, more and more persuasively, with more and more moral force. So, yeah, it's sweet to be with you. It's kind of poignant to be together.